Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Hinwood. Today, economist David Howell discusses the minimum wage increases in California and New York, and Vidar Thorsteinsson looks into the political economy of Iceland as the Panama Papers reveals the country's prime minister to have been the holder of an offshore account. First, David Howell. Howell is a professor of economics at the New School in Manhattan. He has a piece, What's the Right Minimum Wage, on the American Prospects website, prospect.org. Several years ago, when the socialist Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant campaigned on raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, it seemed like a radical pipe dream. But the fight for $15 grew, and over the last couple of weeks, we've watched the governors of New York and California racing to see who'd be the first to sign a statewide increase in the minimum wage to $15. Both increases will be phased in over the next several years and won't take full effect until early in the next decade, meaning that the real value won't be $15 in 2016 dollars, but more like $13. The New York version exempts the areas of the state north of New York City's suburbs. The California version allows the governor to suspend the increase in case of a recession, a move that would probably worsen the downturn. But still, these are major increases, and not only good news for the low-wage, but also a sign that our politics may be finally starting to evolve beyond neoliberalism. The cliché about minimum wage workers is that they're kids just picking up a few extra bucks, but that's not true. According to work by the Economic Policy Institute, minimum wage increases of the scale of New York and California, if imposed nationwide, would affect significantly more workers over the age of 55 than teenagers. The average age of the affected workers, in fact, is 36. Most are primary earners in the family. Well over a third are single parents. A third of black and Hispanic workers would get raises. Had the minimum wage kept pace with productivity growth since 1968, it would be almost $19 an hour, not $7.25. Had it kept up with the average worker's wage, it would be almost $11. Okay, now to David Howell. There's a belief that minimum wage workers are just, you know, kids picking up a few extra bucks, and it's really not a large portion of the workforce. Just who is paid the minimum wage or close to it?
The answer to that is that it used to be the case that it was more teenagers, but over the last 20, 30 years, increasingly large share of the workforce is working at very low pay. And those are workers in classic cashiers, retail clerks, and surprisingly, a large share of very low-paid workers are working in nonprofit organizations and in government, actually providing caring services. Most minimum wage workers are adults and are in families with children. So it's not a simple secondary earner teenage problem. It's a serious, very serious issue. This New York State and California proposals would generate increases for a third of the workforce in each country, in each state.
Now, of course, the argument against increasing the minimum wage, especially to this degree, not just, you know, 25 or 50 cents an hour, but by about, 50%, or doubling it, actually, that this would result in massive job losses, and the cliche is, of course, you'll only end up hurting those you aim to help. Any truth to this?
No, there's no justification for that. Those who are most opposed, serious researchers who are most opposed to the minimum wage on ideological grounds and on their view of how the low-wage economy works, have found that there are negative employment effects only for teenage workers in disadvantaged communities. I mean, there's no statistical evidence for job loss above teenagers. It just doesn't exist. Now, it's true, this is those tests have all been done on experiences of increases from $7.25 or from $6 to $10, let's say, and most between $8 and $9. We're talking here about increases to $15. Yes, it's in that when it affects a third of the workforce, I think we can expect some job loss, very minor. But I would go with the Berkeley Labor Center's estimates that for New York State that there might be as many as 78,000 lost in New York State for a $15 minimum wage phased in over time to 2022. But that would be if the entire state went to $15. The deal that was cut between Cuomo and the legislature has resulted, if it continues to stand, upstate minimum wage, everything above the suburbs of New York, of just something over $12. So this 78,000 estimate assumes that the whole state would go to $15. But, you know, that's offset, as the study shows, by the increase in consumer demand that would be caused by a third of the workforce earning substantially more than they currently earn. They're going to spend more in their local communities. And it will also reduce the means-tested public assistance that is a large share of the social spending that the state and the government does.
You mentioned this compromise where the upstate regions were going to get a lower increase in minimum wage than New York City. I mean, people have been arguing that what's appropriate for a high cost of living region like New York City might not be appropriate for Utica or Schenectady or someplace like that. Is that fair?
I think it's overblown. I think a phased-in approach, as in California, is the way to go, so that the whole state achieves the same minimal level, because this is about achieving a basic, minimally socially acceptable standard of living for families with a full-time worker. The reality is that retail clerks, cashiers, earn about the same upstate New York as they do in New York City. The difference in cost of living and in pay is most dramatic at higher income levels, which are affected by the minimum wage. So I think this is greatly exaggerated. EPI, the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, has a nice family budget calculator. And they've done this for cities around the country. What are the basic needs of, let's say, a single person? No family members at all. Just what are the basic needs to achieve a socially acceptable level of income in the community? And what they found is that for this year, the latest, a lot of listeners in California, in Bakersfield, it's $1,464. In Phoenix, it's $1,410. Closer to home here, it's $1,403 in Buffalo. This is about twice our current minimum wage. This is just a basic needs budget for a single person. If you had a child, so one person with a dependent child, you get 2 to 3 times the minimum wage. It's the necessary budget. So back in Bakersfield, it's $2,359 for a mother and a child to maintain a basic, decent living standard. And it's 3 times the current federal minimum wage. Going back to the previous question, I also want to add that while this increase seems gigantic, as you pointed out, it's doubling, $7.25 to $15, but there are 2 points there. One is it's phased in over 5 to 6 years. And the second is that both New York and California have state minimum wages that are around $9. New York State's is now $9. So it's not an increase from $7.25. It would be an increase. The effective increase would be from the current state level, and that reduces it quite dramatically. A third point is that what is the real value of a $15 wage that we don't get to for 5 or 6 years? Well, it's not $15 today. $15 in 2022 is worth $13.34 today. If we were only, upstate New York is only going to make it to $12 in 2022, that's about $10.90 today. And to put that in perspective, Costco has just announced that they're paying their workforce across the country for starting pay, workers just starting the job, $13. That's barely below the $15 minimum wage that wouldn't apply for 6 years.
You mentioned that what you call this no job loss criterion for whether to increase the minimum wage or how much to increase it. And you think this is really an inappropriate standard. I was amazed by this quote you have from Eleanor Roosevelt in this article. Everyone will agree that a business has no right to exist which cannot pay every employee a living wage. I can't imagine any political figure saying something like that today.
Eleanor Roosevelt was married to the president, and I'm tenured, so... we can say things that we believe. Yes, that sounds radical, but there is no justification in today's economy, with the productivity levels that we have today, which have increased 200% in the last 30 years, where wages have been absolutely constant. There's been no increase at the barely an increase at the median, and actual declines below the median, you know, the 20th, 30th percentile. People who earn between $8 and $9, actually workers in those jobs, cashiers, retail clerks, are earning less than they did 30 years ago. And it's just unconscionable. If a firm has no ability to pay its workers a first world, minimally socially acceptable wage, I think Eleanor was right. It shouldn't exist. There should be public, it should be phased in, there can be subsidies, but ultimately we need to move to a high road economy, and that means we don't pay Mexican wages, we don't pay Bangladesh wages. We can't compete at that level. We have to compete on a high road basis. That was Eleanor's position. I think she's right.
There is that argument you're going to hear from business interests and conservative and even centrist Democrat politicians that there's a Mexican who's going to take your job or a Chinese person who's going to take your job, and you just have to live in this flat world where somebody who's going to work for pennies an hour is nipping at your heels. What do you say to that?
That's an impossible position to take seriously. You cannot simply tear down barriers to labor flows across countries and expect American workers to compete with workers from directly from Guatemala or Bangladesh or Malaysia. If you think that the Trump backlash is extreme, anything approaching that would cause terrific upheaval in the country. I mean, the point of government in a capitalist economy is to slow down change, to take advantage of the dynamism of the system, but to protect those who are harmed by it, to slow down the process so that there's time to adjust. That's why we need to have a phased-in approach so that employers who have adopted a low-wage, low-road model, that is, they're trying to compete on the basis of low wages, they need 4 or 5 years to make the necessary adjustments. And the experience we have, the data that we have from this country and from other countries, shows that that's possible. It happens. The UK has instituted a new minimum wage in 1999. That minimum wage has increased faster than the median wage for workers, faster than the growth of GDP. It's at a level substantially above the U.S. level now. There has been no evidence of job loss from any research.
I'm speaking with David Howells, a professor of economics at the New School in New York City and the author of a piece in the American Prospect, What's the Right Minimum Wage? Well, you know, any pundit who's been through Econ 101 will tell you, you know, raise the price and it's going to decrease demand, and the same thing is true of the labor market. Why does that not apply in the case of wages?
Well, it doesn't apply because the labor market isn't the labor market for simple commodities like oranges. The labor market and the product market, these are not perfectly competitive markets, as the ideal textbook model presumes. You know, that model is developed to teach fundamental principles and then to relax the assumptions and really learn about how the real economy works. I mean, that's the best interpretation of the perfectly competitive model that I teach and we all learn if we take economics. What happens in the real world? Well, in the real world, there's a surplus pool of workers who are lined up outside McDonald's and outside retail stores, willing to offer their wage because there are no other opportunities. There's a surplus, and in that case, employers have bargaining power. And if they adopt the low road, like Walmart, they'll pay. And this is what they did until very recently when they got such bad publicity, close to the minimum wage. If they want to adopt the high road, like Costco, they'll pay $13 to starting workers. What can employers do instead of laying off workers? If labor costs go up as a share of operating costs, not just labor costs, but low-wage labor costs, what can they do? Well, we know that at higher wages, there's less turnover. And turnover is very costly, even for McDonald's, even for fast food restaurants. It's very costly. So there's going to be savings there that many franchise owners don't understand. They, you know, they've lived in a low-wage world where they could pay anything they wanted. But all the evidence we have shows that turnover costs are substantial. There are productivity gains from reorganizing the workplace. There is also the rescaling pay inside the firm. Most firms have a very unequal distribution of pay inside the firm. All we would need to do is lower the rate of increase of the top half of earners, especially the CEOs and the top executives of the firms that own the franchises, and redistribute that downwards. The point about costs is it's about the share of total operating costs. And you can compensate for paying people at the bottom more by paying people at the top less.
That's not very welcome by people above median incomes, though.
That's true. It's a moral question and it's a political question. There's also the possibility of increasing prices to a point that doesn't have much effect on demand, and there is leeway there in many operations. There's also the possibility of taking lower profits. So there's a whole range of channels through which higher labor costs can be dealt with without cutting back employment. It should also be underscored that what employers can do is cut back hours. And many workers prefer fewer hours. If you were to get $15 instead of $7.25, you could cut back your hours by half. And that sounds like a pretty good deal. You know, so you can, and for the employer to save money, you would cut back by more hours. But you have to recognize that workers who are working fewer hours are getting paid more. And so there's kind of an offsetting effect there. The issue is very complicated. It's going to vary from firm to firm, from region to region, sector. But the upshot is that most firms can find ways to accommodate a mandatory wage increase without large-scale hours or employment losses. In places like France, there's a subsidy to employers. If you employ minimum wage workers in France, you pay a much lower social security tax, for example. There are many solutions to the employment problem.
A few weeks ago, I interviewed Ann Bailey, who is now an English professor, but a former truck driver, spent some time as a truck driver, and she makes the point that the miserable working conditions and pay that long-haul truck drivers have to endure are one of the invisible costs of our regime of low consumer prices. Americans are used to paying or crave low consumer prices, but it comes at a cost to the workers, right?
It does. Our model of capitalism and our the economics we learn is really one that is biased, I would say, towards the interests of producers, of owners, employers, and consumers. The goal of a strong economy is to reduce costs so that prices fall while maintaining high profits. We've seen that in the last since the Great Recession of 2008 to 2009, profits have skyrocketed. Prices have stayed nearly constant, hardly any inflation at all. But worker pay has stagnated or fallen. The interests of workers, in your case, the truck drivers, they're the ones who are paying the price of this model. Again, in other countries, this is not the case. In France, for example, the minimum wage is automatically adjusted upwards for inflation. On top of that, there's a second level of adjustment, which is half of the increase in production worker wages goes to an increase in the minimum wage. And on top of that, the government has the power. They don't have to go through the legislature like we do, which in our case, with the Republicans dominating Congress, it never happens. In France, the administration can summarily increase the wage. So you see an increasing real value of the minimum wage in countries like France and Australia and the UK. Workers also consume, so they're interested in low consumer prices as well. But we can't ignore the fact that no matter how low prices go, you know, realistically, you need wages. And that has to be a third leg of the stool. It's not just profits, not just low consumer prices. It's wages. In the old model, the golden age, 47 to the mid-70s, the assumption was that profits would turn into growth, and growth would turn into productivity, which would be shared with the workforce. That model doesn't exist anymore. Since the late 70s, there's been essentially no sharing of productivity growth. Profits have been kept within the firm, within the financial sector, within executive offices. So we're dealing with a very new reality here.
Going back to that Eleanor Roosevelt quote, that no business that can't pay a living wage should exist, has a right to exist, this reminds me to some degree of the classic days of Swedish social democracy, which they mandated compression in wages, but also increase in wages, and if a business couldn't make it, didn't have the productivity growth to make it, it should go under, and that was considered, actually a humane social policy. Are you advocating a kind of new standard for judging economic policy that is a departure from the American way of doing things?
No, I think this is the American way. This is certainly the this is straight out free market fundamentalism. This is what Friedman would argue. Milton Friedman, the great University of Chicago libertarian economist. And this is what we teach in ECHO 101. If you can't produce a product that consumers buy, and we would simply add that it's produced in a way that isn't dangerous to the producers, dangerous to the consumers, and provides a minimally decent wage, you go under. What we do now is we subsidize employers who pay very low wages through means-tested social programs. So Walmart employees will be lined up outside of the Walmart store the minute before midnight when they can, the next day, make use of their food stamps because they've run out of money and run out of food stamps in the previous month. So the very same workers are not earning enough at Walmart to be able to pay to get through the month. And so, you know, what we do in a very minimal way compared to other countries is subsidize working poor families who have full-time heads of households through redistribution. The classic American way was for the government not to be involved at all and to let firms who can't sell their products and can't pay a decent wage go under. The kicker here is that because we have a surplus pool of workers, because we have many workers who the economy just still isn't strong enough to provide workers with the bargaining power to demand a decent wage, we have workers who are willing to accept such low wages. In the past, we had unions that played the role of organizing workers, and that's another piece of the change that we've experienced over the last few decades.
That was David Howell, a professor of economics at the New School of Manhattan. His article, What is the Right Minimum Wage, is on the American Prospects website. Howell mentioned how hard it is to get a minimum wage increase through a Republican-dominated Congress. In fact, low-wage workers have fared no better when Democrats control the legislative branch. I was mystified by Howell's claim in his last answer that driving unproductive firms out of business, which I said was a cornerstone of classic Swedish social democracy, is actually consistent with American history. I sure don't see much Swedish social democracy in our past, but maybe I'm being too cynical. It's certainly not consistent with Milton Friedman's thinking. He was against minimum wage laws and described them as job-killing and mandated discrimination against the low-skilled. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News.
It's a big job getting by with nine kids and a wife. Yeah, but I've been a working man, dang near all my life, and keep on working long as my two hands are fit to use. I drink my beer at a tavern and sing a little bit of these working man blues. I keep my nose on the grindstone, work hard every day, get tired on the weekend. After I draw the pay, but I go back working. Come Monday morning, I'm right back with the crew.
That was some of Working Man Blues by Merle Haggard, who died the other day. Educated urban commie aesthetes like me aren't supposed to like country music, but I do. And by playing that song, I don't mean to reinforce notions that the modal worker is a white male who toils with his hands. It's just a good song, and Merle Haggard was a great artist. Next, Vidar Thorsteinsson. The publication of the Panama Papers, a huge trove of documents from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca, which set up offshore shell companies for the world's rich and powerful, has created a political crisis in Iceland. The documents revealed, among many other things, that the Prime Minister, Sigmundur Gunnlaugsson, had offshore accounts. Icelanders poured into the streets, and he resigned. What does this all mean? Vidar Thorsteinsson has an article on the Jacobin magazine website, posted just before the release of the Panama Papers, on the political response to that crisis. Here he is with an audio update. He's also a graduate student in comparative studies at Ohio State and a political activist in his home country. Vidar Thorsteinsson. So it seems like, 8 or 10% of the Icelandic population was out on the streets demanding the prime minister's resignation yesterday? What's up?
Yeah. Yeah, 7-8%, something like that. More than 20,000 people in a country of 350,000 is phenomenal. I think it's the biggest popular protest that we have ever seen in Iceland's modern history is my feeling. And it's a response to the Panama Papers. It's the fallout of that. Of those revelations where, you know, it has come to light that the Prime Minister of Iceland was actually the owner of offshore banking accounts in Panama and or in the Caribbean. And not only is that considered sort of scandalous in itself, it's also the fact that he has attempted to conceal this. He did not sort of own up to it when he was confronted in a very, I would say, sort of a polite manner by journalists, even though he was sort of set up in the interview. And what's happening right now in Iceland is a political crisis. The current government, which came to power in 2013, actually a conservative centrist government, is probably gonna fall. And right now there are things are happening very fast, and the president has gotten involved, and it looks like there's either going to be a new government formed or possibly an early election.
What was his reputation going into these revelations?
I guess Prime Minister Gunnlaugsson has never been seen as one who is particularly smart at handling PR. I think that's safe to say. He has a sort of like an awkward persona, awkward presence. But it's definitely a surprise that he would have been involved in I don't know, such ludicrously, I suppose, stupid act of selfish corruption in a way. But he actually came to power in a way that is interesting because, you know, he represents this party called the Progressive Party, which is a centrist liberal party, formerly an agrarian party, which was actually very closely involved in the sort of various scandals and excesses of the Icelandic finance boom. in the early to mid 2000s. But Gunnlaugsson came to power after the finance crash, and he was seen as the sort of like the new face of the Progressive Party. And perhaps most astonishingly, he was the one who led the Progressive Party's return to power following the economic crash of 2008-2009. So in the elections of 2013, he advocated for reform ideas relating to homeowners' debt. This sort of like bold, unusual idea, which was to put a tax on the foreign creditors of the bankrupt banks in Iceland, and to use that money to sort of alleviate the debt burden of homeowners in Iceland, of mortgage holders. And even though his party has never been a huge party, it actually helped them save face, and it actually gave them a lot of support and a lot of renewed political legitimacy, shall we say, and allowing them to get back into government after the finance crash. But, you know, so we're seeing these kinds of ups and downs happening now, and it seems that a lot of the sort of political capital that he had gained in relation to these mortgage reforms is now gone, and it leaves sort of a void.
Now, these offshore bank accounts he had, how long has he had them? What kind of, how much money does he have to stash away offshore? Is he rich?
He's quite rich by Icelandic standards. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact amount, but I mean, it's an inheritance that his wife got. She's someone who, you know, comes from the Icelandic capitalist class. Also, Gunnlaugsson's father is also from the Icelandic capitalist class. So, but I mean, they're not like astronomical amounts of money. It's just, you know, it's just someone's personal wealth. So, I mean, I think the scandal itself is seen as mostly just having to do with this not wanting to share the same conditions with Icelandic people. And also, ironically, Gunnlaugsson has been a strong advocate of maintaining the Icelandic currency, which is this mini currency called the krona. He's fiercely opposed to, for example, the European Union and to adopting the euro. And yet he has his own funds, you know, invested in these offshore banks. This is also used against him and seen as a Hippocratic act.
The financial crisis now is getting to be pretty old. I mean, it was, what, 7-8 years ago. Do Icelanders still feel it? Is this still very prominent in Icelandic politics?
It's really cast a long shadow in Icelandic politics, for sure. And I think what's happening now in some ways is a kind of a part of the sort of like long after effect of the crisis. Yes. However, economically, Iceland has done incredibly well, as I think, you know, some people as I think many people actually know. So yeah, there's a continued political crisis, and the political landscape in Iceland is still very much fluid and changing. And I think, you know, when it will come to elections following this, it'll be interesting to see what happens. And it feels to me like a lot of the concern is precisely about these kinds of questions of morality and integrity and following rules, compliance with regulations, that sort of thing. That has tended to be the sort of overarching concern following the financial crisis. I'm a little bit critical of that approach myself, but I think this scandal right now will be put into that sort of frame, and people will say, well, look, things haven't really changed. You know, there hasn't been this kind of renewed sense of accountability among the political class that we were hoping for following the crash. And so, you know, I think it'll be left now to the Icelandic public to sort of reopen these kinds of questions about, you know, where Iceland wants to go.
Now, what is your criticism of that approach?
From a leftist perspective, I feel like there has not really been a sort of sustained kind of the opportunity has not been taken, shall we say, to kind of put these things in a more in a context that would allow for some sort of more systemic criticism of capitalism and of capitalism in Iceland, and to use it to create momentum and leverage, you know, to you know, perhaps do more radical reforms of the Icelandic economic system. I mean, it seems like the sort of following the crash, even the sort of supposedly more radical leftist party, the Left Greens, seemed to accept that their only goal or objective was to basically sort of get the wheels running again of the Icelandic economy, which is a capitalist economy, of course. And rather what has been bargained for is to make these sort of, I would say, quite cosmetic changes to the way things are run in Icelandic society, you know. So, for example, there was this process initiated about constitutional reform, but that has actually completely petered out. There's no new constitution on the way, it seems. And so I don't know. I think there are inherent weaknesses of this kind of sort of technocratic and moralistic approach to the political problems in Iceland. And I think it still remains for the Icelandic left, specifically with reference to what's happening right now, to see if this can be framed in a way that'll show it to be more than just a sort of a scandal of personal integrity or something like that, but to perhaps point out that tax havens are only one symptom of the various ways of you know, exploiting the economic system that, you know, the 1% has. And that is personally what I would hope to see, rather than merely focusing on sort of, you know, cosmetic reforms and that sort of thing. Although, of course, I'll be happy to see Gunnlaugsson removed from office.
I believe you said in your Jacobin article that the goal of the left-green government was basically to put the system back together again the way it was before the crisis, not really to undertake any significant renovation.
Yeah, true. That seemed to me to be very much the case. I mean, I think the situation was estimated as sort of being, you know, everything is going to hell. Was that this was a sort of a moment of absolute crisis? Everything was falling apart. Everything's going to hell. So we have to kind of be in a sort of a damage control mode or something like that, rather than being in a sort of a mode where we try to think forward and see this as a moment that we can use to kind of mobilize for, you know, perhaps a kind of like a long-term strategy for a leftist vision for Iceland. So yeah, definitely. It went into this very, very modest mode of political thinking. It was all about, you know, restoring the functionality of the Icelandic capitalist and financial system.
I'm speaking with Vidar Thormsteinsson, a grad student in Ohio State, who is also a political activist in his native Iceland. You can find an article of his on the political economy of that country on the Jacobin magazine website.
There's a story of the Icelandic crisis and its resolution that circulates outside Iceland that everything was done rather humanely. Social democracy was preserved. The foreign creditors took a hit, but the Icelandic population was largely insulated from the worst effects of the crisis. Is that an accurate representation of what actually happened?
Yeah, I think to some extent it's true that it definitely could have been a lot worse. And I think it certainly was a blessing that, you know, there were these two parties, the Left Greens on the one hand and the Social Democratic Party on the other hand, were able to form a coalition government in 2009, which I think definitely spared the Icelandic population from the worst effects of austerity. So, I mean, I think cutbacks in welfare certainly could have been a lot worse. So, yes, I think it's true that, I mean, other countries in Europe have seen a lot harsher consequences of, you know, economic troubles. I mean, particularly Greece and Spain and the southern European countries. And so I think, I mean, Iceland was not a Greek tragedy. And I think in some ways we can be thankful to the leftist parties for having done that. But at the same time, I mean, they lost a lot of political capital themselves because of various mistakes and disappointments that also happened during that same period. And I think one of them was a lack of willingness to sort of address the concern of indebted people in Iceland. They did not come up with strategic proposals for how to address the concern of mortgage holders in Iceland. And perhaps most disastrously, they sort of chose not to stand up to the British and Dutch governments when it came to the what is known in Iceland as the Icesave affair, which was this debate over the Icelandic state's alleged responsibility over bank accounts that had been opened up by Icelandic banks in or offered to people in Britain and Holland.
What did they do with the Icesave?
Well, so basically the leftist government decided to capitulate almost entirely to the demands of the British and Dutch government. And it was fairly odd for them to do that because they did not have to. They were not legally obligated to do so. And so one of the consequences of this was that there was this, I would say, justified popular anger in Iceland that was channeled towards political forces that are not leftist, but rather sort of centrist, populist, and opportunistic. And this, again, relates to the rise to power of Gunnlaugsson, who we see now going down, because he was able to actually channel this content. And the same can be said actually for the president of Iceland, Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, who actually took a stand against the government during the Icesave negotiations and refused to ratify a law that had been proposed. So, I mean, there were these important moments, I think, of popular anger and discontent that, you know, should have been channeled it should have been channeled and mediated by the left, but those opportunities were lost, and I think it turned out to be quite costly for the left in Iceland. But I think at this point right now, there's perhaps a sort of renewed opportunity for the left to, you know, to harness the popular sentiment and like I say, you know, channel it into some sort of long-term strategy for a left-oriented, you know, social justice and egalitarian-oriented future for Iceland.
What is the popular understanding of how the crisis came to be? I mean, what, do people think about that, talk about that? Has it had any lasting effect? You know, what led to the bubble bursting? What created the bubble in the first place?
Yes, I mean, there was very, very detailed scrutiny over this because it took people by such surprise. You know, I mean, nobody saw this coming, and which is amazing given the proportions of this crash. I mean, truly, it was a major shock. And I mean, I think it's widely seen as a mix of factors. But I mean, I think what people tend to focus on are these sort of concerns over corruption, incompetency, sort of insufficient regulations, these kinds of things. What I think often gets lost in this is the class composition of Iceland and the fact that there is this, you know, wealthy class that has an incredible lot of power over institutions and rules through clientelist networks. And, you know, operates with a sense of entitlement and impunity that is sort of over and beyond the law. And I think, again, this current scandal with the Panama Papers reflects that. I mean, I think it's pretty interesting to see, you know, Iceland being the only, I guess, Western European country where a head of government has been involved in these kinds of offshore accounts. The only other countries where that is the case are Russia and the Gulf countries and things like that.
That ruling class you mentioned, where do they get their money and how do they get their power?
Well, you know, Iceland has a very vibrant, profitable economy that is based on a number of sources. First of all, there's the fishing industry in Iceland, which is hugely, hugely profitable. The Icelandic fish that you can buy in Whole Foods, which is not cheap. This is an absolute gold mine. And it's the fishing in Iceland is heavily mechanized. It's very highly developed. Iceland also has huge fishing areas under its control. So that is one great source of profit. Also, there's heavy industry, and then there's also considerable number of high tech companies. So it's like an overall pretty, you know, vibrant economy. The ruling class in Iceland has always been this kind of consolidation of business interests and politicians, and there's this long history of political parties in Iceland kind of dividing power between them and sort of state and capital, you know, coming together to serve their interests. And I think Iceland overall just kind of has this robust economic performance, and there's this group of people who are very well disposed to take advantage of that frequently, you know, with the help of the state.
And I believe you said in your Jacobin piece that one of the reasons that the Icelandic economy recovered well from the crisis is that productive sector wasn't eviscerated by a financialization. It continued despite the bubble, right?
Yeah, exactly. This is actually something that I think distinguishes Icelandic financialization from other economies where, I mean, I think in the United States, for example, financialization has been this sort of bootstrapping strategy. You know, I mean, it's to compensate for the fact that there's less profitability in other sectors of the economy. People like Robert Brenner have analyzed this, I think, very compellingly. But in Iceland, this was not so much the case, you know. So, I mean, financialization happened very, very quickly, but it wasn't necessarily out of any particular desperation in other economic sectors. I mean, there was also a boom in heavy industry that was taking place at exactly the same time, and other parts of the economy were also doing well. When the economic financial system collapsed, there was something to fall back on. And so, for example, the devaluation of the currency was actually great news for the export sector in Iceland, especially fishing, right? So, I mean, fishing and tourism, for example, have been flourishing in Iceland for the last, you know, 5-6 years as never before. And again, you know, actually the conditions following the crash helped them to do so, particularly with the, yeah, with the devaluation of the currency. And again, that's also something that is, of course, different from Greece, which has been tied into, you know, using the euro. So in some ways it has been helpful for Iceland to be able to use its own currency as a kind of a buffer.
And so as a result of this scandal, the revelation, the prime minister may have to be forced out of office. Who will be the beneficiaries of all this?
Well, it's really hard to say, especially because, and I mean, I perhaps should have mentioned that earlier, this is not only the prime minister, it's not just the Progressive Party, it's also the larger party in the coalition, the Independence Party, which is traditionally this kind of big power party in Iceland. It's the party of capital, the party of the ruling class proper. I mean, so they have the finance minister in the current government, and it turns out that he has actually also had an offshore account and numerous other you know, people in high positions with in that party. So they're probably not going to benefit from this. Even people in the Social Democratic Party and elsewhere in Iceland have actually, you know, been exposed as having had offshore accounts. It seems to have been an incredibly common practice. So it's hard to say. But one thing I think is for sure, I think it's that it will, it or at least it offers an opportunity for the Icelandic Pirate Party to continue its success. I mean, I don't know if your listeners are aware of this, but at the moment, the Icelandic Pirate Party is the biggest Icelandic party according to polls. It has gotten more than 40% support in recent polling, and it's an absolutely phenomenal success story. Even though it still has to translate into, you know, seats in parliament, but we'll see. But I mean, I think the Pirate Party has emphasized these things like, you know, transparency and freedom of information. For a while, they were sort of associated with, you know, WikiLeaks and that sort of thing. They've advocated the cause of Edward Snowden and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, people will see that in context. So it's a great opportunity for the Pirate Party, I think, to capitalize on this and show this as like, this is one of our issues. This confirms what we've been saying about, you know, the importance of transparency and the power of information and that sort of thing.
When I hear the Pirate Party, I think that these are like internet kids with, you know, not a very well-developed view of the world other than openness and transparency and freedom of information. Are there politics beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, I think your intuition there is absolutely right. It is a very narrow focus it's this sort of like technophilia. It is often a somewhat naive belief in sort of transparency itself will solve problems, or just to introduce direct democracy will somehow, you know, have immediate impact. And yes, you're also right that there is a whole array of deep political questions that are not being addressed by the party. And what we've seen is that following its immense success, it has attracted a lot of new members. And they have, you know, very, very different political views. So for example, right now they have a huge contingent of essentially libertarians who are just, you know, of course, free market. And I don't know, some of them are even into, you know, I don't know, men's rights and all kinds of weird things like that. And then on the other hand, you also have people in the party with more, you know, leftist sentiments. And I think it really is going to be tough for them too. And it's already actually a challenge for the party to kind of figure out these things and make up its mind about, you know, what kind of party it is and how it's going to develop policies on these pressing issues of the time. I mean, which I think is you know, economic injustice and economic inequality above all.
Yeah, it almost seems like it would be Reddit coming to Parliament or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, yes, this is the concern, you know. I mean, are they going to be ready or not? But, I mean, I think also this is, again, a great, I think, sort of moment of trial for the left-green party in Iceland. I mean, the left-green party in Iceland is in many ways a party that has a dignified history. It's a party that tends to be pretty solid on you know, on the issues. It's committed to anti-imperialism. It's got a good record on environmental issues. It's excellent on, you know, gender equality and and those kinds of things. But I think, you know, the sort of the challenge is, again, are the left Greens going to be able to kind of frame all these corruption scandals as being somehow an issue that, you know, should make you want to vote radical leftist party? Why would you want to do that? So it's a question of, I think, you know, showing it as having something to do with the, you know, structural characteristics of capitalism and to make this into an anti-capitalist issue. And I think if they can manage to do that, I think they might be able to regain some of the momentum that they had following the crash, but which they sadly, you know, lost after having taken a seat in a government that I think was far too modest in its approach to social reform in Iceland.
That was Vidar Thorsteinsson, a graduate student in comparative studies at Ohio State and a political activist in his home country, Iceland. His article on the political economy of that country can be found at the Jacobin Magazine website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more Merle Haggard. This, it's not love, but it's not bad. It's not often that you hear that kind of understatement in a love song. Till next week, bye.
She was always there each time I needed you, holding on to me like I held on to you. We still don't have what you and I once had. No, it's not love, but it's not bad. No, it's not love, not like ours was. It's not love, but it keeps love.